So today, as I've already mentioned, we're going to talk about the self, the I, ego, me, you, us. And it's useful, I think, not to think that the ego is some sort of special, rather dubious part of our experience, whereas I'm okay. Ego is just Latin for I. And it's quite common in Buddhist teaching to get the impression that the Buddha said there is no self. And in fact, anatta is very often translated as no self. And there are teachings within some schools that say that that is in fact literally true. That when we examine the five aggregates, or the nama rupa vijnana that we looked at yesterday, all you will find are impersonal processes, but no self. And therefore, there is no self. Now, this is a view, I think, that doesn't actually hold up, either in the light of the early canonical texts, where the Buddha frequently uses the word atta, self, in a perfectly non-problematic way. And nor, I think, does it hold up in terms of just an inquiry, a reasoned inquiry into the nature of who we are. At the very least, I and you are ways of acknowledging the difference between us. I think it would be very difficult to function in a world in which all there was were lots of impersonal mind, physical, emotional, mental processes, but no eyes, no way of differentiating really between you and me. Very difficult to see what you would therefore have compassion for if it were not other beings, other persons, other selves. Now, of course, this is a topic that is discussed and explored in quite some considerable depth, particularly in Madhyamaka philosophy. Madhyamaka philosophy is the school of thought that began with the great Indian thinker Nagarjuna, who lived probably in the 2nd century CE, about 600 years after the Buddha, who explored and elaborated the idea of emptiness and the whole philosophy of emptiness, which we'll go into to some degree, but not in the language of Madhyamaka thought, is a way of seeking to understand who I am, who you are, what this world is. And again, I have to emphasize this again and again and again, not in order to arrive at some kind of quasi-scientific or objective knowledge of how things are, but always in the context of providing a framework within which to practice and live, both in terms of our own inner work, our own spiritual life, as we may call it, as well as our ethical relations with others. So we're not looking for objective truths about the nature of the self. We can leave that to philosophers and cognitive scientists and so on. If the Buddhist view happens to coincide with that, all the better. If it doesn't, I don't think it matters a huge amount. In any case, we don't want to get stuck on tying Buddhist ideas to something that happens to agree with it at this point in the development of, say, Western philosophy. That's a dangerous thing to do, because Western philosophy is in process of changing all the time, and we don't want to let Buddhism get somehow tied onto a particular historical element of it. I'm going to start with a passage that I'm sure many of you have have come across in the past. It's on the handout that was sent out last night, if you have it, about 2 or 3 pages. And all of the passages that I've selected for today's talks, address the idea of self. Since I've mentioned the term emptiness, the Buddha hardly ever uses this word. There are passages in which it's used in the Pali Canon, but they're few and far between. There's one or two in which he does acknowledge that emptiness means emptiness of a self and what belongs to a self. But he doesn't really explore or develop the idea of emptiness. Far more common is the term simply anatta. And I'm going to translate that as now is becoming more and more the accepted translation, and that is not self. It's only one letter different, but that makes all the difference. The body, the mind, etc. are not self, rather than the body, the mind, experience. There is no self within it. That's a very crucial difference, and that I feel quite confidently is what is closer to the meaning of anatta. So it's not a denial of self, it's acknowledging that most of the candidates we have for defining self are not self. But that doesn't negate the idea of self. This first dialogue, it concerns Vacchagota, who's a person who crops up a lot in the Pali Canon. He's not a Buddhist, but he's someone who keeps coming up to the Buddha and asking difficult questions. In other words, he's an excellent foil for the Buddha's teaching. He's not some devout student who's just trying to sort of elaborate on something the Buddha he's already heard, but actually is actually challenging the Buddha. So Vacchagota asks, "How is it, Master Gautama? Is there a self?" And this is the question, a good place to start. The Buddha remains silent. "How then is it, Master Gautama? Is there no self?" And the Buddha again remains silent. Vacchagota got up from his seat and went away. In other words, he wasn't getting an answer, basically. He found this was a bit of an unsatisfactory response, to say nothing. Ananda, I don't actually have this in my handout, Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, then says, "Well, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you tell him?" And then the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "If I had answered, there is a self, this would have been siding with those who are eternalists. And if I had answered, there is no self, that would have been siding with those who are nihilists." Now, I think this dialogue alone makes it very clear that the Buddha is not saying there is no self. I mean, he's in black and white, it's clear, he's not saying that. Because he's acknowledging, I think, something really rather more subtle. That self is not something that can either be categorically affirmed as existing or categorically denied as not existing. Now here we actually hit up on some rather difficult philosophical ideas. In fact, in the Western tradition, this goes right back to Aristotle. Something either is or is not. Something either is A or is not A. We've mentioned this already, the law of the excluded middle. There's nothing in between. And this is built in, I think, in a way, to the very structure of language itself. And we tend to get tricked by the structure of language, or as Wittgenstein says, bewitched by language, such that is and is not, which is an absolutely essential component of our everyday speech, are taken literally, as though there some things are and other things are not, in some sort of essential way. Now, the Buddha's actually suggesting that self, and we'll see later on, actually anything, we will start with the idea of self, but what is true of self, will it turn out to be true of anything else? But let's just stick to self. We cannot affirm that self exists, and at the same time we make another mistake if we say it doesn't exist. It neither is nor is not, in a way. And yet at the same time it's weirdly both. Now this leads to the Buddha invoking these two terms, eternalism and nihilism. And these he regards as the two, usually translated as the two extremes. But the word in Pali, I suppose, can be translated as extreme, or it has been. But the word is anta, which means limit, literally, or end. And I.B. Horner has a good translation for this. She says, dead end. These are two dead ends. You're probably familiar in the Buddha's first sermon, where he speaks of two other extremes, or as I prefer to use Horner's expression, dead ends. The dead end of indulgence or infatuation, and the dead end of mortification. In other words, either you lead a life in which you commit yourself to maximizing sensual enjoyment and pleasure and see that as your goal, which is a dead end because we'll never actually achieve the sort of deep well-being we seek simply through indulging the senses and pleasures. And the other dead end, the other extreme, is to think, therefore, I have to somehow cut myself off from sensory enjoyment. I have to deny myself things. I have to somehow detach myself. And this leads, in extreme cases, to rather self-punishing forms of asceticism. And the Buddha famously engaged in a lot of these practices in order basically to cut himself off from the demands and the desires of the body, and to achieve a kind of indifference, we might call it an equanimity, in which the demands of the body are no longer having any effect on his sort of stony indifference. So you punish yourself, you don't eat, or you stand on one leg for 15 years, and this is still being done in India today. Of course, for us, it's unlikely that if we get a bit disillusioned with the sensory material world that we'll say, okay, now I'm going to stand on one leg for 15 years. I think we engage in rather more inward forms of self-mortification. Or we adopt, you know, certain kinds of regimes in which we deprive ourselves of things. Perhaps we go to the extreme in some cases of cutting ourselves or literally causing ourselves pain in order to be able somehow to rise above that pain. And the Buddha saw those as two dead ends. And he describes his teaching as a middle path that does not veer or get caught up in these dead ends. Now remember that a dead end, an anta, doesn't go anywhere. That's why it's called an anta. It's a stuck place. It's a fixed position. And the Buddha expands this principle idea from indulgence in pleasure or indulgence in self-mortification to a deeper philosophical view in which it becomes equivalent to holding a view of what he calls a sasatavada, a view of permanence, or a view of uccedavada, a view of cutting off, which we translate as nihilism, which I think is quite accurate. So eternalism and nihilism. In other words, a commitment to the idea that there's something in our experience that does not change. And the sense we usually have for that is something to do with my innermost essence, what I really am, not my thoughts or my personality or my character or my history, but something that has all those things, the real me. And this is terribly compelling because it seems so self-evidently true. I, for example, can remember my younger childhood self, Stephen at the age of 5, let's say, playing with my toys. And it feels quite obvious to me that the person who 50 years ago played with his little toy cars is exactly the same person who's talking to you now. In fact, we could argue that it's not really possible to have a meaningful sense of who we are without that intuitive certainty that there is someone who had all those experiences. Now, that would be, if you buy into that, if you say, yes, that must be true, then you have adopted what the Buddha would have called a view of permanence, eternalism. And I think a lot of religious beliefs are actually premised upon our assenting to that deep common sense intuition. And so the idea of a permanent soul, of an eternal soul, of something that doesn't die, or we might phrase it nowadays more in terms of some sort of unchanging witness of experience, is often mentioned in some teachings. Sorry?
What was the word? Unchanging?
Witness.
Witness.
The idea that there's something in the background, something much deeper or more transcendent almost than anything that I can notice, that doesn't change. And some thinkers feel that that is the basis actually for constructing a whole understanding of self and liberation. That we need to recognize the true nature of that knowing witness, and we'll find that actually it's identical to the divine, and we need therefore to differentiate ourselves and to disidentify with our what we have and what we think and what we do and who we think we are, and come more and more back to that true sense of self, that Atman. But it's the same word, Atman, Atta, self. The other extreme is to, and again, I think Buddhism probably has a tendency towards nihilism, if anything, is that it tends, and again, the example I gave, we look into our body and mind and our emotions and our feelings in meditation, and we cannot find any self at all, and we therefore conclude there's no such thing. There is no self. It's just impersonal processes. That is a view you might hear in Buddhist teaching. But I would argue that that is actually a nihilist view. And the Buddha is trying to find, or no, not trying to find, the Buddha is presenting a middle way view in which he doesn't lapse into the extreme of thinking there is a permanent sort of unchanging self of any kind, nor does he reject that there is a self at all. So it's a middle way between these two positions, between these two convictions or beliefs, that there is no self or that there is a self in a real sense. Now this, I think, comes right to the core of what I feel, and I think many Buddhists feel, to be the most original insight that the Buddha had, and that is the insight into conditioned arising, or paticca samuppada. I think we've already mentioned this. In fact, in the account of the awakening that I find the most compelling is the Buddha's account of having become awake through seeing Ida pachayata paticca samuppada, the this conditionality conditioned arising. And as I think we already looked in the previous couple of days, how this is really a description of how everything comes about in dependence upon circumstances, causes, conditions, and having come about, it too becomes a cause, circumstance, condition for what will then subsequently arise in the future, and that, when it has arisen, will come a you get the picture. In other words, the Buddha is what we would nowadays call a process thinker. He recognizes that when you look into any, especially a living organism, a living thing, like that dove out there, you cannot, in the end, reduce it to either something that is or something that is not. Instead, conditioned arising, contingency, conditionality, whatever you call this, is it slips through or is uncatchable within the grid of language. In other words, in the grid of it is or it is not, I am or I am not. And it's something, therefore, that is that transcends the capacity we have to define or identify or locate in any final way what it is that's going on. And particularly in relation to one's own sense of who you are. In other words, the self, as the Buddha understands it, is actually a process. It's an evolving, adapting, changing story. I think that's perhaps one of the best ways to look at it. Again, that's an idea taken from certain forms of in modern thought. We often find this idea. The self is actually a story. It's ongoing, it's adapting, it's changing, like any kind of organic, evolving a being. And that's why we can't really say that it is, because it's never standing still. It's never fixed in one place, even though it might appear that way. And nor can we say, well, it doesn't exist, because evidently, although it's not one particular reducible thing, it's constantly unfolding. Now, this is a very liberating insight. And of course, we have to note, I think, the most crucial point here is the Buddha's not an academic philosopher. The Buddha's not concerned in getting students through their PhD courses. The Buddha's concerned with arriving at a liberating vision of life itself, in which we can flourish as persons and as communities and as societies. And as we'll see when we come to some of these later texts, that this same analysis is applied to the Indian caste system of the day. In other words, he's not just talking about our subjective sense of personal identity. This equally applies to our sense of who we are in our social identity, our caste identity, for the Buddha. So let's move on to the next passage, which is saying much the same thing in a slightly different way. And this is another dialogue, but this time with a fellow called Kacchanagota. I'm not quite sure who he is, but it seems by the phrasing of the question that he's a Buddhist. He's probably a monk, because he's instead of saying Master Gautama, he says Venerable Sir, I think it's Avuso. Right seeing, or right view, what, in what way is there right view? So in other words, this is a question about a particular feature of the Buddha's teaching. This first step of the Eightfold Path, Sammaditti, right view. Maybe just say a few words about that. The word right is probably the wrong translation. At least I think it's a bit misleading, because it suggests a sort of moralistic right and wrong. In fact, you'd have right view, wrong view. You know, it's not entirely incorrect, but I've always felt it's got a sort of whiff of moralizing about it, being right and being wrong. The word summer actually means something like complete or whole, which of course would lend itself to being translated as integral. But integral means whole, integer means a whole number. So an integral view would be one in which there is a completeness, a wholeness implied. Micchaditi, the opposite of that, is something like a non-integrated view, we might say, or an incomplete view, or I don't know, in Tibetan at least they translate it as lokvidawa, a view that's somehow back to front, somehow going the wrong way. Perverse, we might even translate it as. Of course, there is a sense of one being right and the other being wrong. But I don't like the harsh kind of judgmental sense that those terms often convey. A colleague of mine in England started translating it as appropriate view. I think that's quite good, actually. Because that suggests that there's not really a right and a wrong, but really a view that's more appropriate to leading the way of life that would follow from the Buddha's ideas. What's the appropriate thing to do in the situation, rather than what is the right thing to do? What's an appropriate way to see ourselves in terms of this practice, in terms of our lives, rather than what is the right thing to do? Right conveys to me a kind of authoritarianism, almost. Whereas appropriate, I think, is much more in keeping with the Buddha's vision. Yes?
How would you say about the understanding of skillful?
Yes, skillful, I think, would be good. I'm just trying to get round any sort of term that sort of fixes. So skillful, appropriate, integral maybe.
Wise.
Wise is a way that it's often translated in the Vipassana community, wise view. But unfortunately, that's not what the word really says. One hopes that it is wise. But wisdom is a very important word elsewhere in the text, and I think it's confusing to think that it might be the one used here, which it's not. But yeah, that's okay. We don't get bogged down in these semantic questions, but it's worth at least stepping back and not just assuming that the English translation we're used to is the only one that's possible in this case. It's not. In any case, the Buddha is often asked about samaditi, skillful, wise, appropriate, authentic was the one I played with for a while too, authentic view. In any case, sometimes, you know, he gives different answers to this question, but this is the answer he gives to Kachana, to Kachanagota. I think, again, gets very much, it's very close to what he's saying to Vajragotha, except in a somewhat more technical language. He says, this world, Kachana, for the most part depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and on the notion of non-existence. Now again, in Pali that's ati and nati, which in some ways would better be translated as the notion of it is and the notion of it is not. Ati is actually not literally existence as a noun. It's actually a verbal form. It is or it is not. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it is with correct intelligence, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And one who sees the cessation of the world as it is with correct intelligence, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. Okay, we have to unpack that. This again comes back to the idea of conditioned origination. That when you recognize how, when he says origin, it's samudaya in Pali, I think it might be more accurate to say the arising of the world with correct intelligence. And the word intelligence is how I translate panya, usually translated as wisdom. It is, strictly speaking, means something like intelligence. In other words, when you realize, when things come into being, when things arise, you really can't say they don't exist. And when things pass away or change, you can't really say they exist. In other words, existence or non-existence are categories, or it is or it is not, are categories that cannot capture the fluidity and the contingency and the processual nature of experience. And I think this is what we find very often in meditation, is that when we close our eyes, or even if we don't close our eyes, when we just learn to sort of sit still, become open and present to what's taking place. And again, what the Buddha's doing in mindfulness is he's trying to stabilize attention and then slowly expand it to the totality of our experience, of the all that we spoke of 2 days ago. And when you do this, and again, the exercise we did yesterday and I briefly repeated this morning, we find that all of these terms that we use, like contact, feeling, perception, inclination, attention, all of these things, are meaningful as kind of pointers, as sort of a rough guide to experience. But when you actually open yourself to the immediate felt sense of experience, you find that you're in a seamless whole. And it's very strange, actually, when you begin to experience the world this way, that there is no dividing lines in experience itself. There's no, as I said yesterday, there's no point at which the cooing of the dove stops and your hearing of it begins. There's no point at which your bottom stops and the cushion begins in experience, as you actually feel it. And the same is true also in time, that we talk of causes and effects, which is a useful way of describing things, but in reality we can never find a cause and an effect. I mean, just take a very simple, I'll run you through a little sort of thought experiment. You have a seed and you put the seed in some soil, let's say in a little pot, and you water it, and you put it out in the sun, and you let it germinate, and it begins, a little sprout thing comes up. If any of you have read Madhyamaka philosophy, you'll be aware that it's always talking about seeds and sprouts. This is the classic example. The seed gives rise to a sprout, and then the sprout grows. We all know this from experience. And at some point, the sprout becomes a little sapling or a little something a little bit bigger, begins to form the shape of a recognizable plant, and then that plant differentiates into, let's say, a geranium, and produces a flower and more seeds, etc. Now, again, we're talking about something that is not divisible into the categories of cause and effect, as though where does the cause end and the effect begin? There is no. It blurs. The seed blurs into a sprout, and the sprout blurs into a sapling, and a smaller plant, and then that blurs into a geranium, that blurs into a flower. We're talking about an unbroken continuity that we can usefully describe in terms of seeds and sprouts and flowers, but when we observe it, none of those stages are actually definable. You can't actually draw a line and say, "Oh, now it's become a sprout." I find this sort of reflection very, very helpful, and I think that what the Buddha is, in a sense, pointing to, and is something that he may well have actually understood through his observations of the natural world. At least I like to think that. It would seem to make a lot of sense. you know, someone living in the forest, sitting still, not doing a hell of a lot, observing closely what's going on around him or her, will start to wake up to this. That what we're pointing to, in fact, in another word, is to me the mystery of life. How strange it is that these processes are constantly unfolding and playing themselves out, becoming other things, and yet the language we use to describe it, in a sense, denies what's going on. We want to break it into nice, manageable bits, which has its advantages, it has its uses, clearly, but it's somehow misrepresenting the actual process itself. And we can see it in our own story, our own lives. From how we were all little babies at one point, we were all fertilized over at one point, and we're going to be, if we survive, we're going to be wrinkly old people. And then we're going to be, yes?
Yeah, just a question. The observation of phenomena is an ongoing continuum. Why does it negate the notion of cause and effect?
It doesn't. The cause and effect is the way we talk about it, but it doesn't negate the idea of it exists or it doesn't exist. But those concepts and those categories, however useful they might be, are not actually observable immediately in experience itself. That they are ideas that we impose upon for perfectly good reasons, but they're not actually there.
Yesterday you encouraged us to look into our direct experience and to see that we can actually discern the cause and the effects of action.
That's the way we talk about it, and as an instruction, that's useful. But again, it's an instruction that's useful, but it's not useful in terms of answering the sorts of questions that are being posed here. Like, what is the is there a self, is there not a self? Where it's a different kind of discourse, which I think the Buddha is essentially pragmatic, and he's giving us tools, he's giving us, he's saying, craving is the result of, it's a consequence of one's attraction to pleasure, and I think you can observe that. But again, all I'm trying to get to here is this kind of primary sense that the world is not reducible to any kind of fixed, discrete category of is not, cause, effect.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
I think that a good metaphor is that we are capturing a digital view of the world while the experience is analog.
Yeah, possibly. That might be another way of looking at it, yeah. But, yes, I guess. Digital and analog. Yeah, maybe. Well, however, whatever, as long as you get the basic point, which I hope I'm getting across, then find a words and language for it that work for you. I don't want to impose my terms on you, but the important thing is to try to get the point the Buddha's making. Okay, so he concludes this passage with all exists, or everything is, kachana, is one dead end. Nothing exists, or all does not exist. This is another dead end. Without veering towards either of these dead ends, the Tathagata, in other words, I, the Buddha, teach the Dhamma by the middle. Again, middle way. So, here we have, I think, again, this is not terribly easy, these kinds of texts. They're quite, in a sense, quite technical. This particular passage, it's called the Kachanagota Sutta, the discourse to Kachanagota, is the only text that is cited by name by Nagarjuna in the Mula Majjhimaka Karika, in the verses on the middle way, which has apparently recently been translated into Hebrew. And if you look through them, that is the primary text of the Madhyamaka school of thought. And this arguably is the canonical basis for the whole of Madhyamaka thought, as a matter, if you want to pursue that, because it's the only text the Buddha cites by name. Nagarjuna cites by name as a source for his thinking. I'm going to stop there, because in the next session, after the break, I want to look at the social implications and the ethical implications of these ideas, which the remaining citations will point towards. And so we have 15 or so minutes. If anyone has a question or a comment, this would be a good time to look at that. Yes.
Would it be correct to say that the Buddha is saying, as a phenomenologist, that we don't have answers for these questions, and they're really unanswerable? We know certain phenomena that make these kinds of conclusions not useful or even dangerous, so you can't frame it that way, you can't answer it that way, we don't know it that way.
I think that's probably a way of saying it, yes. But like all teachers, and the Buddha clearly is not only a very skillful teacher, I think he's also a very profound thinker. He is, he cannot help but use language. He cannot help but he uses it extremely skillfully, I think. And of course, silence is a form of language as well, not saying something. Is also, in a sense, saying something. And if you ask your wife, "Do you love me?" and she doesn't say anything, she's saying something. You don't have to speak in order to say something. So I think the Buddha's silence is a form of saying. In Heidegger distinguishes between sprechen and sagen. That sagen doesn't imply words. I think the Buddha's silence is a very good example of saying something without speaking. Mm-hmm. So we're caught in a kind of, I think, perennial dilemma between being speaking animals, thinking animals, logical animals, reasonable animals, and yet. That very skill we have, which in a sense makes us human. I mean, this is, I think, both in the Buddhist tradition and in the Greek tradition, what defines the human is the capacity to speak. Logon, zoon, ekon, the rational, the logos animal. In Tibetan, they define the human as mashe dungo, the one who's able to speak and understand meaning.
Hmm.
And yet, that very capacity that, in a sense, liberates us from, in a sense, a life that's just concerned with survival, like a cow in a field, we can imagine then a world, we can imagine a future, we can begin to evolve into a culture, into a civilization. This is what makes us human, anyway. That very capacity is a double-edged sword, because it also entails that we misrepresent our experience. We, in a sense, become, I think, alienated from actual immediate experience. And the more that we become urbanized, the more that we, moving into this digital world, this virtual world, which I think one of the great dangers of this, I think, is this, it cuts us off from our actual natural existence. Our existence as creatures who depend on the earth and the biosphere and our relationships with others, everything becomes virtual and conceptual. I think this is one of the great problems that we experience now. But yet we cannot but live with both. And I think what the Buddha's trying to do is to acknowledge and to reconnect us with our felt experience of being living creatures, and opening to the fact that there's something about that experience that is incapable of being contained within concepts and words. And that the more that we do think of ourselves in that conceptual way, as me and you, we are actually, again, creating divisions where in reality there are none. And this, I think, is really part of the challenge the Buddha faces in his communications. And and again, I think it's also clear that at the Buddha's time too, these same problems that we have now, this same dichotomy, this split between our thinking and our speaking and our language and our felt experience is just as much a problem then as it is now. Yes, at the back, and then Aviv, and then here.
Sometimes when I teach, I teach this subject of anatta, I use a metaphor which I think might be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I start with telling a story, which is true. I read in the newspaper about someone who as a child was a big fan of a football team. And when he became 40 or 50 years old, he bought the team.
Okay.
And then I asked the question, what's the connection between the team that he was a fan of when he was a child and the team that exists now when he's 50 years old? And obviously all the players changed in that time, and I don't know, the coach.
The coach has changed, the manager's changed, the ground has changed, they've moved to another place. Yeah, of course, yeah.
Maybe the only thing that remained is the name of the, maybe also the stadium change, but the name of the group, the team, is the only thing that remained. And the memories and the stories. And this is, for me, is equivalent to the self.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the team, if someone changed, would have changed the team as a whole, like sacked all the players and bring in new players, then probably the fan would not stay as a fan of this group. He would say, this is a totally different group. I don't like this group anymore. But because the changing was gradual, one player left, another player came in, one player left, another player came in, there was a change and continuity at the same time.
Mm.
And this is, for me, is very much similar to the self. I mean, we gain new experience, we forget old experience, some experience, some memories remain with us, some memories change, and this is how we keep the notion of continuity, although we change.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's a very good example. It's a very good example. But I think we also always have to bear in mind, so what? So what? I mean, okay, let's say the self is like that. Why is that an important thing to know?
to be aware of that, I think it's important to know, because otherwise we are too much attached to this self, like this fan who, for him, it was very important to buy the group, because this is his group.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very much attached to our self. I mean, I have to be... people must honor me because this is me. if I'm more aware that this is sort of an illusion, then I can release this attachment.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think there's another question too, is that, you see, I think when we begin to experience ourselves more processually, it actually liberates us to grow. I feel, to liberates us to evolve, liberates us to take risks, to do something outside of our normal habits. We take ourselves less seriously. I mean, that's a big problem. I mean, we might know all that theory. I don't think these theories are actually that difficult to understand. The difficulty, the challenge really, is how do you use that insight in a way that it becomes a kind of intuitive feel for who you are, rather than just a Buddhist theory about who you are. And I think there, I don't want to discount the value of theory. I think it's unavoidable and important to be clear about these things. But the real challenge is to put that into practice, to actually live, more and more within a fluid sense of your own person. And we so easily get caught up in. We have a very strong instinctive hold on me. If somebody, which happens, if somebody writes a very critical review of one of my books, which happens, I don't say, "Oh well, that Stephen who wrote that book doesn't exist anymore. He's moved on." I do say that sometimes, but it doesn't actually help totally in my feeling of being. Attacked, or my feeling of being abused, or my feeling of being not taken seriously, and all of that sort of emotional stuff that goes with this view of self. I mean, that's to me the important bit here, is that it's the emotional investment we have in this sense of being a fixed person that's the problem, the real problem, and that's not so easy to overcome. And that actually takes, you could be the world's expert on Madhyamaka philosophy and still be very neurotic and uptight and selfish and so on. So how do we cross that bridge? That to me is the great challenge. And I think we find that in fact these views the Buddha's talking about are not just philosophical positions that we have sort of arrived at reasonably, but they're actually ways of describing a deep emotional attachment to things, which seems to be built in to our neurobiology, probably, at some level. It's been a survival advantage. It's given us a survival advantage to feel that we're permanent. In other words, you can imagine in an earlier period of human history, our ancestors, the ones who would have survived would have been the ones who would have been perhaps most convinced that next year, when the harvest ripens, we'll be there to enjoy it. Mm. I mean, I think is again probably part of what has led to the sorts of the so-called success of human beings. The problem now is that those kinds of needs are past their sell-by date. And yet we're stuck with this biological inheritance that where we still persist in this very fixed notion of me and mine and holding on tight to all of that. So what the Buddha's saying, and I think it's remarkable in a way that he comes up with this 2,500 years ago, is primarily a challenge to how we actually emotionally invest and are committed instinctively to these views. That's the challenge, and one hopes that through meditation, through ongoing reflection, that we begin to dissolve some of these ties. That's the practical, that's the challenge. It's very easy to say Nibbana is the ending of greed and hatred and delusion. There may be moments in our experience when we're nice and still and quiet and clear in which we don't feel that we're, in a sense, in the grip of those emotions. But to really free ourselves from that, I think, is probably the most challenging thing a human person can do. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then this lady here. Oui, non, toi, you, yes.
I think about just a simple dilemma. The problem is how to continue be responsible when you are all the time trying to dissolve these ties. Because this is the other aspect of this question. How to build responsibility for ourselves and for, mm-hmm. for humanity.
Well, that's what I want to look at next. That's what we're going to look at in the second part of this morning, because I do think that is crucially important. There is a danger that if you give too much emphasis to this deconstructive notion that I'm just a sort of a name or an idea, sort of in changing processes. Where then can you, as it were, commit yourself to a lasting value? I mean, obviously the Buddha is saying this. At the same time, he's giving all his monks vows and rules, which they're meant to keep all the time. So there's not actually a contradiction, but it's difficult, especially when you first begin to think about these things, to find a base for exactly what you talk about, a commitment, ethics, this lady and then this gentleman.
Ani dobrałaby co fait bikshotem inter carré. Et je voudrais rappeler une citation de Jeanne d'Arc lorsque le juge Cochon lui a demandé, et c'était une question très très grave, êtes-vous en état de grâce? Es-tu en état de grâce? Et elle lui a répondu, si je n'y suis, que Dieu m'y mette. Que Dieu m'y mette.
Ah, que Dieu m'y mette.
Et si j'y suis, que Dieu m'y garde. Et il y a dans cette réponse, comme là, pour moi, un élément de jeu. C'est-à-dire,
un élément de jeu.
Mais de jeu, pas de jeu, j'y eux, de game. Et ça, je voudrais mieux comprendre comment cet élément de jeu s'insère dans cette réponse qui est très sérieuse. Et ma deuxième question, c'est...
Wait, let's do that. I'm not even entirely sure. The question has to do with the response that Joan of Arc gave to the judge at her trial.
Cochon.
Pig. you're going to say this again. Or could you try and translate? Translate into Hebrew.
Okay. השופט שאל אותה, האם את במצב של איתה בגרס, מה שנקרא?
חסד.
במובן שאם את מתה עכשיו, את תלכי לגן עדן. זו הייתה שאלה מאוד מאוד חשובה. אז היא אמרה פשוט, אם אני אינני, אז שאלוהים ישים אותי במצב הזה, ואם אני כן, אז שאלוהים ישמור אותי במצב הזה. ואני שאלתי, יש בעיניי הגבלה, יש סוג של גם, של פרדוקס, של זה כן וזה לא, וזה כאילו, זה יפה, אבל קשה לי.
I'm not fully sure, I'm not quite sure I understand. The judge asks, are you in a state of grace? Right.
Le juge a demandé
yes.
Êtes-vous
en état de grâce? Et Jeanne d'Arc a répondu,
si je n'y suis pas,
if I'm not in a state of
grace,
if I'm not in a state of grace, then God would not have put me here.
No.
God will put me in this
state. Ah, wish. Et si je n'y suis pas, et si je suis, que Dieu m'y laisse.
Right, okay. And if I am, that God would leave me.
Yes. Would keep me in that state.
In the state. Okay. Well, this is a very different kind of language.
French.
It's, well, not only is it French. it's a different way of talking about these things. My sense is that this is similar in a way. But I have difficulty with theistic language. God and grace are not words.
C'est juste le paradoxe. C'est pas le langage lui-même.
Okay, in terms of paradox, it is probably pointing to something very similar. Yes, but I can't say much more than that. Okay.
Deuxième question.
Il faut faire rapidement parce que
très rapidement. C'est la question des étapes comme Piaget par exemple. Il y a eu un moment
de Piaget.
Il y a eu un moment où je ne savais pas faire de la bicyclette, il y a eu un moment où je ne savais pas lire, il y a eu un moment où je n'étais pas enceinte, plusieurs moments où je n'étais pas enceinte. Donc, il y a avant, je m'excuse, une demi-heure avant, je n'étais pas enceinte, et une demi-heure après, j'étais enceinte. Il y a
un moment.
Il y a un changement. Et chez les enfants, par exemple, souvent, ils ne savent pas faire de bicyclette, ils sont malades, et quand ils guérissent, ils savent faire de bicyclette. Il y a eu.
Yeah. So this is about the stages of developmental child development within the theories of Piaget, about a child who at one period does not know how to ride a bicycle, and the child might then fall ill, and then when they're healed they will know how to ride a bicycle. Or you could say there was a period when I was not pregnant, and then a period after I was pregnant. Is that right?
The moment I was alive and the moment I was dying.
Yeah, the moment
I saw my mother 3 months ago, there was a body and she was gone.
That's true.
Okay.
That is true. And no, I'm not denying the fact that, yes, there are moments of disjunction. But in fact, if you analyze even those moments, you go on forever. It's a bit like Zeno's paradox of the arrow, you see. It's somewhat similar to that, is that I remember my mother, she posed this question to me as a child, and it really, she said, if you have a frog that is 3 feet from the pond, and every jump it takes is half as long as the one it just took, when will it get there? It never will. And so at some level, you know, we say, you know, there is the period of not being pregnant, the period where you are pregnant, but if you go into it, it's very difficult to actually pinpoint a definitive moment, because I think moments, again, don't exist in reality. Moments are human concepts that usefully break our experience down into manageable segments of time that we can then talk about. But in actual fact, it's very, very weird, but it's very difficult to actually pinpoint in experience where that ends and where it begins. But yes, obviously the spermatozoan at a certain point will contact the ovum. I leave that as an open question. Last question.
It's not really a question, it's more of a of thinking. From your vast experience in the Tibetan tradition, and in view of what you said right now, that the philosophical attitude, after some time you get used to it, it's not that hard to understand,
right, yeah,
and to adapt. And what you said right now is that actually the problem is more emotional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with emotional means, like what you can say the those kinds of Buddhism that we put on the other side, they are good at that. So don't you think that there is
What are those other kinds of Buddhism?
Like Tantra.
Oh, I see.
Or,
okay.
I mean, emotional energy investment in that kind. So don't you have a feeling that once we have digested the... And I think for Western people, it's... I don't want to be... but it's not too hard a philosophy,
mm-hmm.
as a philosopher.
No, it's not.
So once you go beyond that step and you understand it all and you can tell everybody the truth and teach everybody quite easily all those things, don't you think there is a time for really going into the more emotional side that will enable us to digest it,
mm-hmm.
and change our lives?
Yes, absolutely. If you don't do that, it's not really of much purpose, frankly. It's intellectual entertainment. But you see, again, if you look at the structure of the Eightfold Path, that is exactly what happens. I mean, you start with Samaditi, right view, mistranslated. That leads you, but what follows from your view? What follows from your view are your intentions. That should lead you to make a choice to do something. And that will find form in your speech, in your actions, in your work. Now, again, I think we can expand that nowadays to include things like, let's say, emotional work or therapy of some kind. And then you have, of course, that leads you to the right effort, applying yourself in a particular way. And that then leads you into mindfulness, into concentration, which are, I think, shorthand for applying exercises and disciplines that actually begin to make a felt difference. Now, in our world, some of us might need to employ methodologies that are not, strictly speaking, found in the Pali Canon. I mean, therapy would be an obvious example of that. And I think each generation of Buddhists will need to find forms of praxis that are suited to their specific conditions, their specific needs. And to me, one of the great richnesses of the Buddhist tradition is that that's what it's done. I mean, when it goes to China and Japan, you end up with Zen, you end up with forms of practice that are really quite different to what the Buddha did. You go to Tibet or North India, Kashmir, Bengal, you have the development of the Vajrayana, the Tantras, and so forth and so on. So
what's your opinion about what is healthy or good in that meaning, besides therapy.
in the Vajrayana, you mean?
No. In our world, in our Western secular Buddhist world.
I think this is an open question. I don't really have an answer for that. I think what is going to be different, possibly, is that practice will become much more individuated. In other words, if you look at traditional religions pretty much everywhere, the practice is defined and then's imposed, and you have to do it right. And sometimes, as people find, you go, and I spent a lot of years in Tibetan Buddhism, I found that the practices didn't really work for me. Now, of course, my teachers would say, well, you haven't tried hard enough. And they might be right. They might be right. But the point is, I felt, and I think a lot of people feel, a mismatch between our own needs, and we've grown up under the conditions in which we have in our culture, and the solutions that, say, Tibetans or Chinese or Japanese have found through their experiences that have been very appropriate. I'm not convinced that we can just import Asian solutions to Western problems. And Buddhism, I think, has the capacity to reinvent itself, to rethink itself in a way that's appropriate to the situations it finds itself in. But we're in a very, very beginning phase of that in the West. And so it's wide open. But the only thing I would like to envisage Buddhist practices that are not of the one size fits all. In other words, the idea, as you get in the rhetoric of many Buddhist schools, this is the highest teaching. This is the most powerful practice. That to me is absurd. It's like saying this is the best medicine. Well, it depends what your sickness is. So I do feel that we might be moving into a more a form of practice that is far more tailored to meet the needs of individuals and communities, not just in a purely egotistical way, but we form communities, we come together out of common interests, like in Tovana perhaps. And so a culture of practice will begin to emerge. But I would hope it would be one that would be open, that would be willing to explore non-Buddhist possibilities that may actually be more effective sometimes, and move forward to that. The real challenge, and we'll look at this a bit tomorrow, is really understanding the dukkha of our situation and what is the most appropriate way to respond to it. We're going to have a 15-minute break. We'll meet again at 20 to 12.